And welcome back. We're in conversation with Dan Gardner, Ottawa citizen journalist, Dan, who's in the process of completing a book on risk and risk perception. And before we continue our conversation, we're going to go to the phone lines, 1-800-580-2372, and speak to David in Arnprior. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I just want to mention to Dan Gardner, I really enjoy your writing with respect to the criminal justice system.
No, thank you.
I'm a former criminologist, and I'm really happy to be out of the field. I'm in a much, much nicer field right now. But your conversation reminded me of I'm actually in the English as a second language business and teaching teachers. And a couple of years ago, I had lunch with a French explorer. He's a kind of a modern-day explorer who went up to Ellesmere Island and went north from there. And the other chap was from New Zealand, and very outdoorsy guy. And they were mentioning to me they felt Canadians had become non-risk takers.
Mm.
We're just so conscious of taking care of our children. And, I mean, Dr. Dworkin, one of the perceptions is that sometimes our houses are too clean these days. You know?
Exactly, yes. And we've had people on talking about how we should be letting our kids essentially splash around in the mud outside.
Well, it strikes me that we're becoming a bit of a soft nation. Mm-hmm. In our overprotectiveness. And I just throw that out to Mr. Gardner in terms of looking at the issue of risk from we need more, perhaps,
yeah.
That we do coddle our children.
Well, you know, I tend to agree, but I widen it a little further. It's not just Canada. It's actually all modern countries, really. Sociologists have been studying this extensively, and there's lots of evidence for this all over the place. In fact, the sociologist who coined the term risk society is a German. You know, and it varies somewhat. The continental Europeans tend to not be so overprotective of their children, for instance, and they are kind of amused at seeing children on skateboards with helmets.
Yeah.
But they have a different set of phobias, shall we say.
Yep. Very interesting topic. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. And on the other side of things, when you look at risk, what about people who, when presented with all the information about tremendous risk, don't see it as risk at all? So the antithesis to the unconscious mind, and one of the topics that comes up is smoking.
Yeah, yeah. This is an extremely important issue. We don't just get risk wrong on the exaggeration side. We also underestimate risks. And the research is very clear on this. We underestimate undramatic things. We were discussing this a little bit earlier. We underestimate diabetes, asthma, these rather undramatic things that kill slowly, they don't get media coverage and so on. And the other thing that we underestimate is things that are familiar. And this is a really essential psychological mechanism at work. It's called habituation. And this actually applies to all animals, including humans. And basically it's this. If you experience something over and over and over and nothing bad or good happens from it, you will basically stop paying any attention to it whatsoever. You'll ignore it, which is why the first time that you go driving, it's a terrifying experience. You're so alert. But if you've driven the same road to work over and over and over again, sometimes you'll phase out so much, you'll arrive in the parking lot and say, how did I get here? Right? Well, the same thing happens with smoking. If you have smoked over and over and over and over and over again for weeks and months and years, and nothing bad has happened to you, your unconscious mind has said, it's just tuned it out. It has just tuned it out. The cigarette in your hand is no longer a threat, mm-hmm. because it is so profoundly familiar to you. Now, your conscious mind understands what your doctor's telling you. Your conscious mind understands that you can get lung cancer and emphysema and all those horrible things, but your unconscious mind cannot be swayed by statistics and medical advice.
Right. That also applies, though, to, I guess, when someone who is smoking, and then they get that heart attack, and then they stop smoking. I guess that's where mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that changes that habituation.
Absolutely. Habituation is, it's all about continuity. It's all about what's familiar. If you've stopped doing something for a long period of time, you know, it can change. A good example is in the early 70s, you know, experts were angry they were frustrated on the other side of risk. They were trying to get people to understand that drunk driving was really dangerous. They were trying to get people to understand that they should wear their seatbelts, and people wouldn't. It took decades mm-hmm. to change that. And again, that goes back to habituation, because if you've driven drunk over and over and over again, you hardly notice it. If you've driven without your seatbelt over and over and over again, you don't even notice it. But today, if it's normal for you to wear your seatbelt and then you don't, you notice it in spades. And today, if you drive drunk and you don't, mm-hmm. you're on high alert because you're thinking, this is really scary, as you should. And so it works both ways.
Let's now turn to some of the media reporting and some of the stories. And we talked about this before in emailing back and forth. Dan and I tend to email each other with various stories, especially with reference to Dan's book, because of some of the examples. These were terrific examples reported in not only Ottawa Citizen, but pretty much in the national news media. And one of them was the environmental assessment of toxins in politicians' bodies and how they had determined there were 54 or 55 different toxins, I use their word, toxins in their bodies. And this became a major report. And politicians were commenting on how we should be doing something about this because it indicates how badly polluted our environment actually is. I'm going to leave this now with you.
This is this sort of assessment of blood or other bodily excretions to determine what is so-called contaminating them is in fact something which environmental groups do quite regularly, and the media report very widely for an understandable reason. When I tell you that, you know, a chemical with a name that's, you know, 4 inches long and is used as a flame retardant is in your blood, it's, I mean, what's your natural reaction? Your natural reaction is, this is horrible stuff. But the problem is this. The fundamental fact of toxicology is the poison is in the dose, is the old phrase. It's not the substance that kills you. It's how much of the substance there is. And so we now have, and now, by the way, this actually comes from very good psychology. Again, it goes back to our ancestors who developed our brains, basically. Their brains developed in that ancestral environment. If you think about it, if you could detect a contaminant in the water, for instance, if you could detect fecal count with your nose, with your fingers, then you really shouldn't drink the water.
Exactly.
Right? That makes good sense, and that's where this emotion of disgust and contamination comes from. There's a lot of good psychological research on this. So we have a good, powerful intuition. But today, we have technology which is capable of doing a heck of a lot more than sniffing the water. It's capable of determining that there's, you know, 3 parts per trillion in the mm-hmm. water, which is to say, nothing. You know, the right. technology can detect things down to a level where it can't possibly hurt you. And so when they say this chemical is in your blood, your instinctive reaction is, oh my God, I'm contaminated. I'm going to be, you know, this mm-hmm. is going to hurt me. Medically, that's just not true. The next question you have to ask is, well, how much is in your blood?
Right.
And if it turns out to be 3 parts per trillion of whatever chemical, there's a really good chance that it means absolutely nothing.
So politicians then, and I remember Jack Layton making a huge deal of this, and more so than many of the other politicians. And I listen to this, and those are the questions that come through my mind. They are then using this as a tool to essentially propagate their own political yep. agenda, but it's disingenuous. I would be happier for them to say, yes, I can see that all these things are in my blood. You know, we should do A, B, and C to determine which ones really are elevated, and if they are at a level that's considered toxic, and deal with it on that issue as opposed to making blanket statements and pretty much scaring everybody because of the way things are being reported.
Oh, that's exactly it. I mean, it's very important work that public health officials do in monitoring what's in our blood and what's in our breath and so on. That's very good and valuable stuff, but it's just totally irresponsible to go and take these results and plaster them on the front page of a newspaper and say your blood is contaminated with X, Y, and Z, because it doesn't mean anything. It might mean you're at risk, or it might mean absolutely nothing.
And we've had similar reports with pesticide exposures in kids. And then there was another one, in terms of reporting risk, when they were talking about birth control pill versus the birth control patch, and how they said that using the patch doubled your risk. And I remember reading this in the paper, and we talked about this on the show, doubling your risk of stroke by taking this patch. And when you actually looked at the data, it really wasn't, it may have been doubled, but they played around and fudged around with the numbers.
Yeah, that's one of the problems is with media reporting of statistics is this. Well, there are many problems with media reporting of statistics, but one of the big ones is this. They tell you about relative risk. So this is a good example because they say your risk is doubled. Well, anybody who hears that is going to be alarmed. But in fact, you have to know doubled from what. And if it goes from, as you say, from 3 in 10,000 to 6 in 10,000, and even that was dubious, by the way.
Right.
But if it does go from 3 in 10,000 to 6 in 10,000, in practical terms, your risk hasn't changed. So the media really do a disservice when they don't provide enough information for you to make that determination. And unfortunately, that happens all the time. A good example is when West Nile virus arrived in North America, the media reports, there's some really good research on this, the media reports all, you know, to give you a sense of the risk, they all reported how many people had become sick and how many people had died. Well, if I tell you that 19 people, you know, a new virus has arrived and 19 people have been killed by it, should you be afraid? Well, instinctively, your instinctive reaction is, yeah, I'm afraid. I'm worried. You've got my attention. In reality, you have to ask 19 out of how many?
Right.
You know, if it's 19 out of your village of 200, should be very, very afraid. If it's 19 out of 300 million people in the United States, you can really not, you know, go back to sleep, you know.
That's right.
Not a problem. Unfortunately, that problem of denominator blindness, as Paul Slovic calls it, not presenting the denominator, is rampant. It always happens. The other problem with the media is that they very often don't give you any other examples by which you can compare risks. You know, if I told you that some risk, there's a 1 in 3,000 chance that this risk will kill you next year, you know, should you be afraid? Well, chances are, we know from the psychological research, that's probably going to worry you because I've expressed it as 1 in 3,000, and you hear the 1. You envision the 1, and the 1 is you, and you're dead, you know?
Right.
Well, what you need to know, what really helps put it in perspective is, for example, well, your chance of dying in a car crash next year is 1 in, and I'm, this isn't the precise figure, but it's close to this, 1 in 7,000. Well, if I know that it's 1 in 7,000, and then if I know that, you know, I can judge it. Well, how do I feel about that risk? That risk is, I know that one, and I'm not too worried about that one, so I can judge this unfamiliar risk, this information, based on that. The problem is, again, that almost never is provided, you know. And so sometimes I tell you, I've told people where, you know, don't worry about that because the chances of that killing you are 1 in 2 million. And they say, yeah, but what about the one? You know, no, no, do you understand you have a better chance of dying, slipping, and drowning in your bathtub than this? You know, that sort of information really helps put it in perspective.
We're going to take a small break. We have Frank in Victoria who wants to jump into the conversation. In conversation with Dan Gardner, Ottawa citizen journalist, in the process of writing a book on risk. We'll be back in just a few moments. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call.